You know very well, Garcia, that I'm not interested in VPNs, you sneaky bastard. Overall. You said that deliberately to me. I know your sneaky little games.
Welcome, listeners, to episode 7 of Bad Voltage, season 2.
Yes!
Yes! Yeah.
So we got a little bit of a different show due to some scheduling issues this week, but I think we still have a quality show ahead of us. What do you think, guys?
I think so. You know, I think it's the only way. The only way is success.
Yes, well, the only way is success. So what have we got first in this show made entirely of success? You know?
I actually haven't read any Tony Robbins books. I don't want anyone thinking that. So we are today actually going to, we usually do the news and we usually don't mention it in the intro, but we are going to be doing a bumper amount of news. We're going to be talking through a bunch of different things, some really interesting things going on. So stay tuned for that.
Jono has received from, Bad Voltage in general, we have received from Garmin a VivoSmart HR Plus fitness wristband thingy, which does about 400 different things. Jono's been testing it out for us and he's got some thoughts.
And as the resident namer of things on the show, so a little bit of background, when we come up with ideas for segments, I usually, using my wit and ingenuity, come up with names for those segments.
Okay? Terrible names.
There has been frankly, it's been a lot of bullying in this area, where I've been told that my input and creativity is not welcome at the table until these two idiots can't think of a name for something. Okay. So we had this idea that throughout this show, we're going to be having a bunch of individual little segments where we recommend cool stuff that you can do with technologies, essentially life hacks that are not really about your life. So almost just hacks. Okay. But we didn't like that as a name. So we decided in our infinite wisdom to call it all of the names that we came up with merged together as one. So therefore, this segment will be called A Hacks, Sack Crack and a Hack Wax, Cracker Hack, Hack Jacket, Hack Pocket, Axe Hacks, Max Hacks, Wolfpack Hacks, and a Snacks and Hacks.
To be clear, I'm not sure it should be called all of these things all in one go. I don't want to be named in the middle of a thing which is also called Hack Pocket, which is rather worrying as a name. If
also,
I'm
there is something of a relation to Sack Crack and Hack Wax that relates to you as well.
None of that is good. None of it.
No, none of that is good. So there will be packs of hacks during this show.
It isn't.
Listen out for them.
And now I've ingested into everybody's heads that image of Stuart Langridge face down on at a spa. Just getting
anyway, no. Just
it's the texture of a cat's tongue. All right, enough of that.
Wow.
Shut up.
Yikes. And now, Bad Voltage. The first edition of what we hope will be useful and potentially long-running series of whatever we're going to call it, hacks and acts or tips and tricks, or I'm not sure the name that we're going to come up with for this. But when I initially had the idea for this type of quick, short segment where we could each give you kind of some kind of software utility that we use to save you time and one that we're surprised that more people don't use. Now that initial idea has kind of morphed now, and I'm going to go out on a limb and say Stuart's going to probably give you some kind of time zone related wizardry, but at least for this initial entry, I'm going to stick to the original idea. And one small utility that I use that I'm very surprised I don't see more people using is something simple, and it's a clipboard manager. Now, I use Deodin because it just kind of integrates well with Unity and came with Ubuntu, but there's quite a bit out there from CopyQ to GPaste to Clipper. You know, if you use XFCE, there's Clipman, there's Parcelite, there's, as you would expect with Linux, there's quite a few that have a variety of different features. And for those of you not familiar with a clipboard manager, it's just a little utility that runs in the background of your system and keeps a history of everything that you've saved to the clipboard. Now, like I said, they kind of run the gamut as far as features and toolkits used and what they look like and how they operate exactly. I think there's a couple things that you're going to want to take into consideration. The first of them being, how well does it integrate with your desktop, whether, you know, depending on what shell you use or what desktop environment, what window manager. I would tend to want to pick one if I were you that goes and integrates well into that environment. Now, that said, I think there are some features that I would consider must-haves and then some that maybe are just kind of nice to have. To me, it has to be able to exclude programs. You don't want passwords and things of that sensitive things of that nature going into your clipboard manager. As I mentioned, I like the integration with the shell. I like one that distinguishes between your clipboard, which is Control-C, and your primary selection. If you have that enabled, I still do. It seems like some people that are newer to Linux don't like the distinction between clipboard and primary selection. I know people that have been using Linux a while. That's something that people have strong opinions on. I personally like it. I like the distinction. And I use the two of them jointly quite a bit. Now, some of the other nice-to-have features are command line control and scripting, which I use quite a bit. And some of them, they should be searchable, although the one that I currently use for whatever reason, I don't believe is. And you should be able to use keyboard shortcuts, which is another thing I'm in general surprised more people don't use. So maybe that's an idea I'll have for a future segment is popular programs and how you should use the keyboard shortcuts because they really do save a lot of time. So for those of you who don't currently use a clipboard manager, I encourage you to install one and head to community.badvoltage.org and let me know what you think.
So it's the news.
News.
No, see, that's not what happens now.
You don't like Muse? In the news?
Wow. Now, here's the rule. You are already banned from thinking up names for segments. This one is obviously called The News, right? And you can't fiddle with that. No jingles either.
It's original.
It's new rule.
News. What about at a different tone?
No, still not.
That sounds very different.
No.
Okay. All right.
No.
Okay. Well, tell us some news then.
You may present some news. Jeremy, go for it.
Sure, so I actually picked two kind of news stories for this segment. The first was, I'm sure you guys saw, the House just voted to wipe away the FCC's landmark internet privacy protections, and the Senate had already done so. I kind of don't want to get into the politics of it or any of the details of it. I just thought, one, people should know what's actually happening, which is this really freed internet service providers, obviously such as Verizon and AT&T, but also Comcast and Spectrum and the like, to really roll back protections that were just passed last year that had sought to limit what they could do with the information, mostly around customer browsing habits and app usage history and location data, but even things like social security's numbers, which is a little scarier. And the rules had also kind of provided some rules around strengthening safeguards for consumer data and malware and things like that.
Can I ask a question about that?
Sure.
Because I haven't really, I know we don't want to get into it in too much detail, but how personalized is it? So, is it that Jeremy Garcia in Buffalo browsed, this particular website, or is it just selling, 30-odd-old white male in Buffalo was browsing
this? From my understanding, it's pretty personalized.
Well,
that's terrifying, isn't it?
I think to some extent it's up to the data that the ISP collect.
Right.
The point is that if they collected this stuff before, then they couldn't sell it because of the law, which has now been repealed. So there were obviously advertisers and so on who want this information and want to tie it back to your double-click tracking cookie and what have you.
Right.
But before, there was no point in collecting it because you weren't allowed to sell it. Now, the fact that people can collect it and the market for providing it will create the desire to start collecting it. The point about the law wasn't really to smash people who were already doing this. It was to stop people coming up with the idea of doing it.
Well, I think the interesting thing here is part of the law had just taken effect and part of the law was about to take effect. So you weren't losing a ton that you didn't have. It was things you were going to gain. You are now not going to gain, basically. But besides letting people know if they hadn't heard about this somehow, that they should know about it. The other thing I was going to say is, with the reality that this is coming into play, I think on a future show, maybe perhaps next show, we should do something maybe around VPNs and what do you use and what's good, what's bad, best practices kind of stuff. So I'm for that. It sounds like X for it. So I say we do that next show.
And that
you know very well, Garcia, that I'm not interested in VPNs, you sneaky bastard. Overall. You said that deliberately to me. I know your sneaky little games. I'm not interested in VPNs, but within this context, it is important. I do think we should cover it.
I think there are two things there. The first one is that's an absolute fucking masterstroke of manipulation of the airwaves. Well done, Jeremy. But secondly, people have now got a little bit of warning that we're going to be talking about that. And so you are welcome to, and we encourage you to tell us on our forums or by email about which VPNs you use and why. And that's important because we'd like to collect that kind of information.
You don't like and why.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. Right, I have a piece of news and it is much comedy. Now, I'm not sure, have we actually talked about Amazon Go on the show before?
I don't think so.
No. This is it's a proposal by Amazon for physical shops, but the idea is you can just walk into the physical shop, pick up stuff from the shop and walk out, right? And it will it tracks you around the shop with cameras and millimeter wave and the fact that your phone's in your pocket and it knows where all its products are and everything. So it knows what you've bought and who you are. So it can just bill you.
Didn't they build one?
They have got one in Seattle. It's only open to Amazon employees. It's basically a beta test.
Prototype, yeah.
Yeah, although and there was a lot of hype about this kind of thing, and it seems like quite a cool concept to me. I'll come on to the sociological ramifications of such a shop in a bit. But the interesting thing is that this shop that they've opened, if more than 20 people go into it at the same time, the whole thing just completely falls apart and it can't track anybody. And if stuff gets moved from 20, not 2,000.
2,0. Yeah. Okay. I wasn't sure if the word 20 had been redefined to, 300 or 400.
No. So
how big is this shop? Is it like the size of a cardboard box or is it like an actual sized shop?
Well, the idea is you can walk in there and buy bread and stuff, right? It's not some kind of tiny little hole in the wall that sells rare vinyl or something, right? You're supposed to be able to go and buy sandwiches and things. So
it's just basically Argos 2.0, isn't it?
I'm kind of surprised it works up to 20 people. I mean, having been in a grocery store before, one thing that becomes immediately obvious is that everyone constantly puts items in random places where they just don't belong. Yeah. So I'm interesting how this will save things. Like if someone puts a thing of frozen peas in the cereal aisle, it'll actually know, like, hey, those peas have only been there for 90 seconds. They can go back in the freezer or things like that. So it's,
I mean, to be honest with you, there's a whole bunch of complicated ramifications and thoughts around IT and personal tracking and computer vision analysis and so on. It's all very interesting.
Yeah.
This is just sheer out-and-out schadenfreude, right? That they pimped it really hard when they announced this is the future of shopping. All you scum out there running shops, ha-ha, we're coming for you. And now they built this thing, and it's rubbish. So,
well, they were pretty quiet when they announced it, I thought. They kind of just dropped that video.
You then saw the world going, oh my God, this is it. I mean, yes, fine. Okay, you didn't actually see Amazon saying that. But, this is an example of hubris, in my opinion. I still think this shop will be cool. But
so it's going to be a little bit like Minority Report, though, right? It's going to be like, oh, Mr. Yakamoto, how are those pants? I mean, the amount of refined, targeted data that they're going to get on shoppers is going to be staggering. Staggering.
The thing I find weird about this is not so much the technology is one thing. I think it's kind of cool. It's just the consistent depersonalization of society. It's the same issue I have with Soylent, It's like to me, the act of eating and having dinner with people and things like that, or even just taking time away to have something to eat is important. And I think the act of going to the store is important as well. Although I say that as a rambunctiously committed Amazon Prime user.
This is exactly the thing. There have been actual, I mentioned earlier the kind of sociological impact of this sort of thing, and that's exactly the point. People are genuinely worried that this sort of shop depersonalizes the act. So a bunch of people who essentially get a lot of their personal interaction from walking down to the shops and buying things, that doesn't happen anymore. They're talking about putting in, you get fast lanes in supermarkets when you want to go through and swipe things and not talk to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
They're talking about deliberately setting up slow lanes, the opposite of that, where you have to go through and talk to people and you talk to people in the queue and there's a cashier there and so on, in order to inject some notion of personality back into the act of shopping rather than just making it a soulless robotic task in which you don't interact with anybody.
I think you get that in the fast lane, because usually what happens is there'll be a conversation and then someone will say, not very fast, is it? Well, those machines are crap. They don't work. Most of them aren't working when you go in there. And I still don't understand whether you're supposed to put stuff in a bag or not. I wasn't sure whether the bag is part of the validation process for the fact that you bought something.
The bag costs you money. I should be clear, having a conversation with the machine where the machine says, please replace the item in the bagging area, and you go, it is in the bagging area, is not a conversation. That does not count.
I don't have many friends.
Next piece of news, John Bacon.
That's going to... Yes, so I have two pieces of news. The first piece is that AT&T have joined the Linux Foundation. Now, this might not seem particularly interesting from the outset, but they've basically joined as... I knew you were not going to like this. They've joined as a Platinum member. What I read said that this follows news of the company's contribution of several million lines of eComp code to the Linux Foundation, as well as the new open network automation platform, ONAP, based on production-ready code from AT&T and OpenO contributors. And this guy called Chris Rice, who's a senior VP at AT&T Labs, has joined the LF board of directors. Part of the reason why I think this is cool is telecoms is a notoriously difficult industry to kind of breed openness in. I remember going to a session with a bunch of big telecoms when I was at Canonical one time, and it was fascinating watching like the dynamic in that room and how people wanted to be a part of this thing, this open source thing. They can see the value in it, but not really willing to kind of put first foot forward. Yeah. So to see AT&T join the LF, I think is as significant in many ways as Microsoft joining the LF. It just sends a really positive message about open source.
I see your theory. My experience of working with telecoms people, and this is more mobile operators than big picture AT&T style stuff, but everyone is very happy to join industry consortia and be on this board and be part of this discussion group and so on and so forth. It's when it comes to actually doing anything that's the problem. And it's not clear to me that AT&T... I mean, the LF are basically an industry pressure board, right? I mean, we like to think of it as kind of all lovely and fluffy and everything, but it's all made up of big companies.
Well, right. Yeah, I mean, it's a trade organization. That's the point, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, as far as I'm aware, AT&T are actually, I mean, as I just read out, they've contributed several million lines of code and they are actively participating in various projects. So I think it is happening.
Having
I don't think this
for
is
some
like
very large telecom companies, getting open source in there is mind-bendingly difficult at times, especially I worked at them quite a while ago and it was exercise in futility sometimes, even trying to explain what open source was to the higher ups was
just title for the show.
Okay,
title for the show, exercise in futility.
Exercise in futility, that's what I'm calling it. Don't get me wrong, not a bad idea, just only one thumb up from me.
I mean, I don't see anything wrong with it, but it's got to be a step in the right direction.
Yeah,
and I seem to remember you had a similar view on Microsoft joining the LF.
I did. How much has that helped? Very much. Where's my HoloLens driver? Oh wait, nowhere.
It's Jesus Christ! You're so entitled.
You take your VS Code and go to the corner.
Okay, VS Code's actually right. Quite good. Don't get me wrong. So.
All right, you sell out. The other piece of news, and this is not really big news, but it's news that I think is very much related to many people who listen to our show, is that the venerable Linux Action Show has decided to close its doors, and the last show is going to be a live show at Linux Fest Northwest soon. So, you know, just a big shout out to Chris and the crew over at Jupiter Broadcasting, because
Chris and Noah,
it's
well
been
played.
Going for like, what, 9 or 11 years or something like that. It's been around for a long time.
Yeah, so, a long time.
And it was interesting. There was this little—I don't know if any of you guys saw it—but there was this interesting segment on the Linux Action Show where it was kind of refreshingly frank, where they were basically saying, "We keep making changes to the show, we keep trying new things, and people aren't watching it. People aren't listening.
It doesn't seem to be grabbing people's attention." What I thought was interesting is that they're not shutting down Jupiter Broadcasting. They're doing other shows and they're pulling in other people. So, you know, Joe Ressington from Late Night Linux, Linux Luddites, as was. He's doing a show now there, and Noah's going on to do another show and so on. So they're still doing things, which is interesting, you know.
Yeah, I wonder why, like, I am curious about why things kind of drag down for that show, because, you know, if you're interested in Linux, arguably it doesn't really matter which show you watch, you just watch shows that have got Linux in the title to a degree. And a lot of the content at Jupiter seems broadly fairly similar, right? I mean, it's different types of content, but it's not like... It's not like comparing the Bloomberg PNL podcast and Bad Voltage, you know?
Yeah, I will be interested to see what changes and how they feel about it 12 months from now. But, you know, all that aside, well played to the Linux Action Show for sticking it out for this long. People who listen to it, feel free to come and listen to us or go and listen to the Ubuntu podcast.
We'd like that. No, don't go and listen to them. Don't go and listen to the Ubuntu podcast. Listen to us. That's what you need to do. Well, don't listen to anyone else.
listen to us first, but we haven't got a Telegram channel, and the Ubuntu podcast people have, so, and it's nice hanging out there, so.
whatever. Do we have any more news?
I did make a note of that. Do you see the new home for the Google open source stuff?
Yes.
I thought that was interesting for two reasons. One, I knew they did a lot of open source. I did not realize they had over 2,000 projects. Right, and be able to browse by category and tag and language and full text and all the other stuff was actually pretty nice. There was a couple interesting projects I discovered that I didn't realize were Google, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, which sort? Good.
And now I don't even remember what...
Sorry, I wasn't intending to put you on the spot. That was just curiosity.
It was,
it's cool.
It was one of the ones that isn't hosted on GitHub. It was hosted on their internal stuff, which is probably why I didn't know about it. I do have a complaint here and a question aimed at one stewarding language. Why is web design so horrific these days? All that white space with those blurbs flying around and transitions and animations is not a good way to show information. Stop doing that.
Well,
explain yourself, language.
First of all, not responsible for the whole web design industry.
I'm aware. Thank you.
There are arguments. People are doing these things because they are nice and engaging and so on. I mean, yes, you might disagree. It's hard to make that case without sounding like the sort of person who says, I hated it when the web stopped being black Times New Roman text on a white background.
I'm not asking for an amber blinking cursor here.
It'd be interesting, actually. This is a thing I would be genuinely interested in, not right now, but you sit down and come up with half a dozen examples. This could be a good forum discussion, I think, actually. Things where you think this site is bad for the following reasons. And not ones where the problem is that it pops up millions of ads and all that kind of thing.
Cryogenics.org.
You're talking about just bad UI or UX.
Sites that you think are examples of bad web design, which people think are popular. And it would be interesting to talk about whether everyone agrees with you, what we think is the sign, what we think are the signs of a site which is not doing that. I mean, the immediate thing everyone jumps to is that you get a million Facebook pop-ups and ads and all that kind of thing. But you seem to be suggesting something beyond that entirely. It's not about ads getting in the way of the content. It's about the design getting in the way of the content.
I think even the new Google Plus design compared to the old one is much less information presented in a much less aesthetically pleasing manner.
It's certainly less information dense. Whether it's less aesthetically pleasing is the subjectiviest of subjective questions, I think. One other very, very tiny piece of news, and this is really tiny, but I'm nevertheless going to mention it because I did it. Our downloads, show downloads, will be over SSL, HTTPS, from now on. So that's quite cool. Nice. Not very exciting, but nonetheless, thought it was a good idea. So,
I don't know. I'm just lighting the fireworks right now.
We're in the process of moving. Shut up! I can make you do it.
Yeah, because that'd work out well, wouldn't it? That would work out just great for everybody.
Which is precisely why I did it. But the Bad Voltage site. Good work, the Bad Voltage site itself is not SSL yet. I don't think.
That's my brother's fault, though, isn't it?
Yes, it is your brother's fault. I wasn't going to say that live on air, but now that you have said it live on air, it's Simon Bacon's fault.
Simon Bacon. Terrible human being.
Right.
And that's the news.
So we've been asked to discuss hacks, small bits of software we're amazed everyone else isn't using. So this time on Axe Pack of Hacks is KDE Connect. What this does is it connects your phone to your desktop. When you get notifications on the phone, they appear on your computer. You can send files back and forth, that sort of thing. Of course, like all applications that are shoved out of the KDE project's collective wormhole, it has the word KDE in its name. Like how Jason Derulo has to tell you his name is Jason Derulo in every track he does. Conveniently, in this case, though, KDE Connect actually has nothing to do with KDE, and it works perfectly fine on my not-a-KDE desktop. I'm sure it depends on a bunch of KDE libraries, but those people who would whine about that might consider spending 15 pence on a hard disk rather than running off floppies, or maybe just shut up whining. Connect pairs up your desktop with an Android phone. I don't actually know if it works on the Apple iPhone, but I bet a fiver it doesn't. This is partially because there's no way an iPhone app that isn't from Apple would be blessed with the ability to do all this stuff, and partially because the project would be deadlocked in internet drama about whether to call it KDE iConnect or iKDE Connect, and so there'd be two forks and neither of them would work. But to be clear, Connect works when your phone's in your house and connected to your network. I don't think there's a facility for it to work across the internet, and if it were, then turning that on would be mind-blowingly stupid, so don't do that. You can send files back and forth, browse the contents of the phone, which is so much easier than emailing things to yourself, or worse, having to plug in a USB cable like some kind of grunting caveman. There's a bunch of plugins that do other interesting stuff, showing your phone's battery life, pausing videos if you get a phone call, using your phone as a keyboard, which I did once just to impress myself, then never used it again. But the Find My Phone thing is alarmingly useful when you've left your phone in the bathroom for the 15th time that day. Really, the only problem with it is the name. Why is it called KDE Connect? It doesn't need KDE, and that just turns people off. Is it supposed to be like a gateway drug, like how the first hit of heroin is free, so you'll be seduced over onto the K side of the fence with huge colourful buttons and its constantly reinvented desktop? Well, I can tell you it hasn't worked on me. Also, that whole thing about the first hit of heroin always being free is bull as well. I went up to a smack dealer in London one time and asked for free drugs because the first hit's always free, and he shot me in the chest. So, in conclusion, use KDE Connect. It's better than being shot.
Recently, the nice folks at Garmin very kindly sent me their Vivo Smart HR Plus activity band to try. There's a little bit of backstory. I've been a Fitbit user for a long time. I've owned the Fitbit 1, the Charge 2, and the Aria. Now, when I say I've owned these, I've actually owned multiple of these Fitbits because, sadly, I've experienced an inordinate amount of quality issues, and I've had to get a number of replacements. While Fitbit support is excellent, I'd rather their products be excellent to avoid the whole annoying mess. So I explored other options, and then the Vivo Smart HR Plus arrived from Garmin. Feature-wise, it does much of the same that the Fitbit Charge 2 does. It counts your steps, heart rate, floors climbed, distance traveled, intensity, and provides sleep monitoring. In addition to this, though, and where the Fitbit Charge 2 is lacking, the Vivo Smart HR Plus includes a built-in GPS, and you can actually use it when swimming. In terms of the build, the unit is well-made and feels substantial. It is an all-in-one strap, so it lacks the strap changes that the Fitbit offers, and this might have been handy depending on wear and tear, or for achieving different looks. Compared to the Fitbit, the display is quite a lot thicker, which may be off-putting for those of you with smaller wrists. The display itself also seems a little dimmer than the Fitbit in general use, and particularly under sunlight. Overall, though, this is a well-made, solid-feeling unit, and these small deficiencies pale in comparison to the overall capabilities of it. Like other fitness trackers, you connect the Vivo Smart HR Plus to your phone via Bluetooth, and your various stats are available there. Garmin uses an app called Garmin Connect as the window into your health. The app features a lot of functionality such as an overall dashboard, and then provides specific details that relate to steps, heart rate, sleep, weight, intensity minutes, and a variety of different sports such as running, cycling, and swimming. It has a feature called Insights, which compares your performance in some areas to other similar users. While the stats tracking is great, the app also includes additional features that relate to community in it too. Now, while the app is comprehensive, it does lack some of the other lifestyle features in the Fitbit app, such as meal tracking and water consumption. It is also a little bit more complicated to use than the Fitbit app. It just seems to lack the usability and polish that Fitbit have put into their mobile apps. In terms of the heart rate tracking, which I do care about, I wore both the Garmin and Fitbit at the same time for about a week, and the results seemed reasonably comparable. I even put on a chest strap to compare results, and the wristbands were, as expected, a little off, but generally consistent. The GPS tracking is not something I've actively tried yet, as I haven't been running for a while, but it does seem to do exactly what you'd expect, and it tracks where you run, provides accurate distance information, and supports different courses. Battery life was also very impressive, and while it died a little quicker than the Fitbit, this thing also packs a GPS, so overall very impressive, and it lasted around a week on a single charge. Mind you, the charger is a little fiddly to attach to the unit. One thing where the Garmin notably improves on the Fitbit is what you can do from the unit's screen. The VivoSmart HR Plus has all kinds of integrated features that relate to notifications, music playback, different ways of displaying information, configuring settings, and more. So, what is the bad voltage verdict? The Garmin VivoSmart HR Plus is a great fitness tracker. It's well built, it has a great range of features, and has stellar battery life. While it may lack a little bit of the spit and polish in the app department, don't let this faze you. This could definitely be your next health fund buddy.
So you've used a bunch of the Fitbits, right? Now I'm not massively experienced with Fitbit stuff. I had a Fitbit One for a while, but I don't need an app to track how much pizza I eat. So, or I do, but the Domino's app does it, so that's okay. But my mum is very, very, very big fan of hers. We got the Fitbit One, and she liked that. And just this past Christmas, we upgraded her to the Aria, and she's a super big fan of it. But it seems like this is the Aria, but it does a whole bunch of other stuff. And it's not as usable. This feels worrying to me. It's got a stupid name. VivoSmart HR Plus.
Well, Vivo is their general brand because they do the Vivo Move, the Vivo Fit, the Vivo Active is their running watch. So Vivo is just a Garmin brand.
Right, okay,
and the reason it lacks some of the apps is because it's a lower-end device. It doesn't support Connect IQ. So the higher-end Garmin stuff has proper apps, where the lower-end stuff doesn't.
That surprises me a bit, that. I mean, so I'm all for the idea that you get what you pay for, right? And you should be paying for the good stuff. But for something like this, where the app already exists and the notional extra cost of the app is zero, it always seems a bit iffy to me to go,
because the form factor and underlying operating system on certain devices is different. So if, like, any Fenix device runs on the same platform, and the newer Forerunners now run on the Fenix platform because they're trying to consolidate their underlying infrastructure and OS styles. But the Smart is just not capable of apps in the same way, so it wouldn't...
You're talking about apps on the device itself. I'm talking about things like the companion app and so on.
So the higher-end stuff can actually run apps on the device.
That's... Right. Who needs this? Anyway, right, you need this, so talk about it.
So I was going to say, in the easy use thing, I would say if you are, your mom is using an example, if she's not very technical, I don't know that I would recommend Garmin stuff in general. They're definitely aimed at enthusiasts of activities.
Yes.
I'm not as familiar with the Vivo Smart, but definitely the Active and the Fenix and their higher-end stuff is really, really good for runners or triathlons or bikers. But it's aimed specifically at that segment, where I think the other devices, specifically Fitbit stuff, is more of a lifestyle device, if you will.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to describe it, because the thing about this is, so the, like I say, I was impressed with the build quality of the device. You know, it feels like it's really well made. And I'm not sure whether it is actually well made, and I just haven't used it enough. And I'm just thinking that because I'm so annoyed at Fitbit with the fact that their stuff just drops to bits.
So like, Garmin stuff's typically very well made. I've never owned a Fitbit anything. Why do you keep buying a device from a manufacturer if you've owned 10 of them and they keep failing?
Honestly, I haven't found anything else that's even come close to a Fitbit.
Really?
So Garmin sent me this to review for the show, and I thought this will be an interesting challenge. I don't want a smartwatch. I want a fitness band. And I want a fitness band with a little screen with accurate health rate, with accurate heart rate monitoring and a decent app. The Fitbit, I think, does a really good job of that. It's just, you know, the quality of the actual experience is great. It's just the quality of the hardware seems to be the problem. And I'm amazed. I don't know whether it's just me or whether other people have experienced similar things, but I posted something on Facebook and it seemed like a bunch of people had similar experiences
This is very true. I mean, talking about my mum's experience again, I mean, the Aria that she's got now, we got the extra strap, the metal strap, the mesh, and that's really cool. But her previous Fitbit One...
Hang on. Isn't the Aria the scale?
Is it an altar then?
You make your mom walk around with a scale strapped to her wrist. Very unkind.
No.
That is
maybe it's called the altar then.
It's a big wearable, isn't it, Stuart's mum?
Shut up. Right, whatever it is, anyway. But the previous thing she had, which was the one, the strap kind of fell to bits. It's just plastic strap. And then she went, okay, I need to buy a new strap. And then the strap, which is just a piece of plastic with holes in, was like £19. But fortunately, because it's just literally a piece of plastic, you can buy 10 for a tenner on eBay. So...
Right. So, yeah, I mean, that's the thing, like with the new Fitbit. So, you know, the Fitbit Charge, you had the strap built in, and then the Fitbit Charge 2, they made the interchangeable straps. I remember when I first saw that, I was thinking, is this because people actually want to change the straps? Or is this because your freaking straps fall to bits all the time and you can just send someone a new Fitbit as opposed to a new strap as opposed to replacing the entire unit?
This is possible, but there is a bit of both. I mean, certainly... Jeremy's point, I think, is the true one here. The Fitbit are basically lifestyle people who are trying to occasionally chuck in a, this is for real runners product. And the Garmin people are for real runners who occasionally try and chuck in a lifestyle product.
I was going to say, of the group that I run with, and it's a fairly large group, I don't know a single person with a Fitbit. Most of them, right. I'm in the minority that I don't have a Garmin because I have the Motorola. Although that might change very soon. Garmin actually today released the Forerunner 935, which is the nicest looking running watch I've ever seen. So I
really,
that might be in my future.
You think you might be getting one of those?
Yeah, I mean, I would like to.
That's the thing. Like that's the one thing, the spit and polish thing, I think is a real distinction. I think, you know, that it's not like the Garmin Connect app is terrible. I mean, it's usable, but it feels like an app that was written by programmers. And I mean that in the nicest possible way, but it doesn't feel like an app that was designed from a consumption, from a consumer perspective, or even necessarily from, maybe hardcore runners and hardcore athletes do want that kind of design. I don't know.
They're definitely a function over form UI.
Yeah.
For sure.
And some of that is that then you know you must be a proper runner because you're using this proper runners thing, which is complicated and the plebs don't understand it. But some of it is also realistically, because if you're looking for something which is high end in terms of the actual hardware and high end in terms of the things it records and the amount of analysis and data it collects and so on, and it's also high end in terms of the user experience and the appearance and everything, it'll cost $1,000 and no one will buy it. So.
Well, so their high-end watches cost about $1,000. Like, if you get a fully loaded Fenix 5 XL, it's like $899, I think.
Okay.
Good Lord.
Have fun with that.
Maybe it's true. So, yeah, I mean, I think if someone's looking for a wearable and you don't want to spend too much cash, you're looking for something that's going to, you know, be dependable. It's got a GPS built into it. So if you're a runner, obviously,
now,
I think this would be a good thing to look at. I mean, you know, the Fitbits with the GPS built in are a lot more expensive as far as I'm aware. And there is the quality issue with Fitbits from what I've seen. So, you know, I definitely, you know, for all there's a few kind of like, you know, it lacks some of the spit and polish. I think it's a great product. And thanks to Garmin for sending it over for us to check out. Like,
now, I have a technology question and you're going to go, I don't know. But can you actually use it from a Linux machine? You're going to go, I don't know. I've only used it with my phone and my Mac, right?
I've only used it with my phone.
So you haven't had to connect it to a real computer at all?
So the way it connects to Bluetooth to your phone, at least if it's like the other Garmin devices, and then it uploads to Garmin Connect, and you can access it via the web. So it doesn't care about the OS.
Oh, okay. Well, that's not too bad. So the whole idea of having to plug it in.
Hello?
What? Why did you stop?
Oh.
Okay, that
was that
weird.
Just a gap that we all heard at the same time? Did we all hear that gap at the same time? I thought my connection cut out.
No, right.
All right,
so
that was odd.
So go back and cut this
bit
out.
Leave that on the show.
No,
don't. I'm going to forget. No, let's keep that. That was genuinely weird. That's one of the weirdest experiences I've ever had with you two guys. Only one of the weirdest experiences.
I was going to say, and that's saying something.
Right. So it'll
given that
so,
one night in Bangkok.
So it connects to your phone that uploads it to Garmin, and then you just look it on the web. So basically, you don't need a real computer anymore for these things.
Correct.
Yeah, I mean, that was actually one of the things when I got the first Fitbit, one of the things that was irritating about it is that it came with this little USB. It almost looks like, you know, like those USB dongles that you have on wireless mice. And it plugged in the side. And it didn't work with Linux. And there was a little project that started up. And
because
I remember filing a GitHub issue where they got some of the stack working, but not all of it. But now it seems like most people don't even connect to their computers. They just sync it via their phones.
Right.
And then, yeah, you access it from the web or something. Now, that's one thing that is interesting. I've not checked Garmin Connect in a web browser, but Fitbit's web app is terrible compared to the mobile apps.
But then anyone who actually gives any significant shit about this just uploads all their stuff to Strava or anything or something, right?
You can't upload to anything else with Fitbit. With Garmin, I think you can.
Garmin Connect will connect to Strava or Endomondo or any of them. Yeah, I would say the analytics in Garmin are pretty high quality, though. A lot of people still use Strava because of the competitive aspect of it, and they like to run with their friends and stuff, but...
Yeah, the community thing, but yeah, but what Garmin do is the analysis stuff, you know.
All right, so for my hack, I'm going to have something a little bit different than the other guys. From time to time, people will ask me, you know, how do you record a podcast and get good kind of production quality? Particularly if your presenters are, you know, based all over the world. And that's obviously something we do with Bad Voltage. I'm pretty proud of the production values that we have. So I wanted to kind of share as a bit of a hack for, you know, recording a podcast when you're not all in the same room, how do you get that good quality production? And this is what you want to do. So, you know, with our podcast, you know, Jeremy's based in Buffalo, the birthplace of the Wing. Stuart is in the deepest, darkest depths of Birmingham. And I'm, of course, in the beautiful sunny climes of California. They may describe it a little bit differently. This is what you want to do. So first of all, get on a Google Hangout. And you just use that as a means for connecting to each other. And importantly, make sure that your video is on. Make sure that everyone's got a webcam. Because that plays a big role in kind of having that connection between a group of people when they're having a chat, okay? You'll see someone's facial expressions, etc., etc. Now what you want to do is get yourself a decent microphone. So for example, you know, we all like the Blue Yeti microphones. That's what I'm recording on right now. But I also use a different microphone for the parts of the show sometimes. These are USB powered. You can plug them in. They're supported on Mac, Linux, Windows, everything. They're all great, right? They're pretty cheap. They're rugged. They look deadly suspicious, though, if you travel with one in a suitcase. Just be one of that, okay, if you don't want to get rubber gloved. And what you want to do is when you have the Hangout, you say, okay, we're going to start recording a segment. And what you'll do is one of you, and in this case with Bad Voltage, it's me, will count to 10. And the other two need to count, or however many presenters you've got, will count to 10 with you. And you'll notice that when you do that, it's really like all over the place because it sounds laggy and weird, okay? But make sure that you start recording, one person counts to 10, and then everybody else counts to 10 with them, okay? Because what that does is that produces these spikes in the waveform that you can use to line the audio up, okay? And, you know, so you finish recording, and then what you want to do is in your multi-track editor, I use Cubase, but you can use Ardour or Pro Tools or GarageBand or whatever you like. You put each of these different recordings on a different track. So we basically, when we finish recording a show, we record each segment as individual waveforms, and then we dump them into Dropbox. I get them off Dropbox, and then I mix it. And what we do is we stick each person on a separate track, and then line those waveforms up. And you'll find you want to go for the 8, the 9, and the 10 should be in line with each other. At the beginning, everyone's all over the place, okay? And you will need to ask your co-presenters to make sure they speak clearly when they say those numbers. And then what you can do is you can line it up and you can trim off that counting, and you will have audio that's perfectly in line. Now, then what you want to do is when you mix the show, what you need to do is this. So first of all, for each track, you want to compress it. And that basically makes the quieter sounds in someone's voice louder and the louder sounds quieter, right? So it sounds consistent. But you also want to pan it a little bit. So for example, in our show, you know, there's three of us. I think one of us is dead center, and then the other two are on either side of the stereo field. And you'll want to apply a little bit of EQ, because we all have different sounding voices, and EQ lets you change the bass, the middle, and the treble of a voice. And that makes everything kind of like sound, you know, distinctive, okay? Compression, EQ, and panning will make it sound $100. It'll sound brilliant. And then what you want to do, and this is critical, this is another important part of the hack, is that when you export that, so you spit that out as a single file, let's say a WAV file, then what you want to do is master it. And what that means is you basically take that file and then you run a compressor on it again and you run EQ on it again, and it'll make it sound like all the bits are glued together. And that's basically how you can produce a podcast. So in summary, get on a Google Hangout or some other service, start recording, one person counts to 10, everyone counts to 10 with them, use that to line the audio up, compress, EQ, pan, spit that out as a WAV file, and then compress and EQ that, and you'll have pretty great sounding audio, if I do say so myself. Beautiful.
Yes.
Thank you for listening, folks. That was a fun show. Right. A bit different, but it's always fun.
Yes. So,
should we talk prizes?
Now we have a thing to talk about, which is the competition that we've got going on. Well, a fabulous, fabulous Dell Sputnik laptop. Those of you who watched the live show will have seen this. Those of you who didn't watch the live show, go and watch the live show, badvoltage.org/live. And at the end of that, there is a competition. So you identify all the fruits that we named in the live show and then go to badvoltage.org/fruit and fill them all in. And of the people who get it right, we draw your names out of the hat, and whoever wins gets a Dell Sputnik laptop donated to us by Barton George and the team at Dell, which is fabulous. Bit of a mea culpa about this, though, because we didn't announce that it's a US-only competition until some people had already entered, for which we are apologetic. Sorry.
We are.
We're not just apologetic, we're also rubbish.
Yeah.
little calm A, little calm B.
Yes, so we are sorry about that, but... But
it's not all bad news, though.
No, we have coming up, and you want to listen to our next time show for this. We have another competition coming up with another cool item.
Yes, we're going to be giving away an endless mission machine, which is the box that we gave away. It's the Endless Mission 1 machine, which is the box that we gave away in the live show that you'll see in the video. This is a really neat, like, little box that runs this cool open source operating system called Endless OS, and we're going to be giving that out to people who are based in Europe as well. If you're based in India or China or wherever else, you'll be also eligible for that as well. But we've just had a lot of complaining from people in Europe.
Yes. So basically, this competition will not be open to you if you're in the US. You have to eat a cheeseburger or something instead.
This is outside the wall only.
We should note on the one that is US and the Dells, the Sputnik, you do need to get your entries in before we record the next show. So watch the live show very, very soon and make sure you go to badvoltage.org/fruit and do it.
After this show comes out, you'll have maybe a week, if you are lucky, to get the entries in. So go to badvoltage.org/fruit and fill them in, and you get to win an absolutely delectable Dell Sputnik.
I'm actually going to throw out a date for you, because this is how I like to roll. Get your entries in before April the 17th, because we're going to record on April the 18th. So
that is perfect.
Get your entries in before April the 17th if you want to win the Sputnik. So, all right. I think that's everything, right?
Yes.
I'll add one quick thing, because I posted it to the forum, but I should let the listeners who don't go to the forum, and if you don't go to the forum, you should, community.badvoltage.org. But if you bought a Nest or Dropcam because of Mr. Bacon's review much, much earlier in the show, I do have a heads up that you can just disable them via Bluetooth if you didn't update it. So don't buy stuff that he recommends.
Really? Yep. Wow.
You didn't see that?
True fact.
Are you still using yours? Don't I?
No comment.
I'm not sure whether that means I don't want to admit that I'm still using it, or, oh my God, I put that up in my living room 2 years ago. It's been streaming to the internet all this time, and I'd forgotten it was there, which seems equally plausible.
We haven't switched on sometimes and not other times. So,
How do you switch them on?
You can set times and, you know, for when they switch on and off.
Right. My question was, do you walk up to it and move the hardware power switch, or do you just turn it on from your phone across the internet?
From my phone.
Ah, good. That seems like a good security thing then. Excellent. Well done. So go to jono.dropcam.org if you want to know what he's doing right now. That's fabulous.
All right, piss off.
It's a great way to get a sneak preview of the show.
Thank you very much, and good night.